Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians in North Carolina. AccuWindow forecast is about 73 degrees and blustery outside. We're on the outer bands of the terrible storms that have come up through Mississippi. Our condolences to those towns and cities and their losses. The solar wind is 362 kilometers per second. Those of you in the South who saw or heard the shuttle come in on Monday, would you please call in and let us know what it was like? I was outside at about 8 o'clock Monday morning looking for it, and it was just too far south of here. We never even got the sonic booms. But if you saw or heard anything, go ahead and call us in. No sunspots for 10 days now. Again, the sun is not doing what solar scientists predict. There have been prominences, though, and if you don't have a coronoscope, then I suggest you go to the new SDO site and check out the video. There's a lot going on in your front yard. You should check it out. Just absolutely stunning three-dimensional photographs of the sun and an incredible prominence, close up and personal. Those people living above the Arctic Circle say the sky never gets dark anymore. The auroras are so constant that it lights up the whole sky, even though there's a mild solar wind. So there's no source for the auroras. Do you think they're coming from somewhere else? If you want to be part of tonight's program, you can call us in 415-762-1161 all night. Don't forget, Remembering the Future is out as an ebook right now as we wait approximately 69 days for it to come out in print. But you can read it now, and if you order the ebook, you get a 25% discount on the printed version by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com. Rememberingthefuturebook.com. $7.95. You can read it now, and you get all the color photographs. When it comes out in print, all that artwork will be in black and white. So you get a little bit of an advantage, and you get 25% off the printed version when it comes out in 69 days. So you can have it, an autographed copy of it on your bookshelves, and still have already read it. Don't forget, Twitter is now alive and well on X Squared Radio. I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement of the expedition, and do our best to launch the nation's first affordable electric vehicles and other great things. So follow me on Twitter by searching for Brooks Agnew. And don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at xsquaredradio.com. It's a short 30-minute program, and the more you click, the more your friends that you send there, the better our chances are of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word. We need something positive out there. All right, tonight we are going to talk about something we rarely talk about on this program. You continually ask for it in Facebook and in email, and so we're going to bring it to you. We're going to cover a few conspiracy theories tonight. Don't go away. 40 seconds. We'll be right back. Thank you.
expand consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Oil. Is it everywhere? Really? You think we're running out? Do you think there's an unlimited supply? Or do you realize that we sit on only 2% of the world's oil reserves and yet consume about 20 to 25% of the world's oil? I say consume. We actually convert it into all kinds of durable goods, which are shipped all over the world, computers and all kinds of plastic parts and automobiles and heavy equipment and airplanes. So it's not all wasted. We are a very industrial nation. But the idea that oil is now approaching $90 a barrel, those of you that are filling up your tanks every week have noticed, probably, in the last 60 days, a gallon of premium gasoline has gone from about $2.75 a gallon. It's now $3.11 a gallon. Are they just warming the water, trying to cook the frog, too afraid to raise it all at once like they did with Katrina? Well, we shall see. It gets a little more painful each week, and I doubt very seriously that your paycheck is going up to match it. And then, mysteriously, we're still investigating to find out what the cause is, an oil rig, a billion-dollar oil rig, goes up with a boom in the Gulf of Mexico. Lives were lost. However, no oil has been spilled in the ocean. I guess some safeguards were in place to prevent that from spilling into the water. But maybe not as costly as a hurricane, but nevertheless, I predict that you'll see the effects of that oil rig fire at the pump very shortly. I think predictions have been made $250 a barrel oil in the near future. We are coming up to the summer months, traditionally higher driving months for at least the United States. In Europe, where gasoline is the equivalent of about $9 a gallon, people get by with much, much smaller automobiles or take public transportation from country to country. Not so much driving about and not so much one person per car in Europe. And in countries like Israel, where they have no natural resources like oil, they have to import everything, and of course they would rather use it for half-track tanks and jets than for private cars. There are concentrations on electric vehicles, charging grids, public transportation, etc., and it's a pretty small state to move people about with 2.5 million people living there and 55 million people around them who hate them and want to push them into the sea. So a lot of pressure on oil right now from all directions, and slowly but surely the prices will go up and the impact on the average person will get more and more severe. I would like to hear your feelings on that. If you want to call in, it's 415-762-1161 here on X Squared Radio. I don't know how much conspiracy theory we can get into with oil. I mean, what has not been covered? Unless you have discovered something out there. I do see that there is technology suitable to replace it that's now on the table. At least one, maybe as many as half a dozen electric car companies are ready to introduce fairly affordable electric vehicles. It's still a new car. It's still something that you have to spend money for and make payments on. However, charging up an electric car in your garage for a few pennies a day is a lot different than putting $200, $300, sometimes even $400 a month in gasoline into your vehicle to get back and forth to work. I think we did the calculations one time when I was younger, and it didn't pay to put my wife to work in a restaurant, because by the time she paid for daycare and gasoline, it was a wash, boys. I think it's pretty much that way in your life as well. So, oil and fuel and clean air, and I know there's a lot of reverse pressure on this because of the now what we have, debunking of the climate change myth, they're calling it. However, that being said, I think in looking at the scientific evidence, there's at least support for the idea that if we're not having a net change in the climate, we are certainly having a range of climate variation. Much colder winters, much hotter summers. It's almost as though the Earth has tilted a little more on its axis, even though we know it has not. Something is making that far more intense than it normally is. The one thing that we have noticed is since 1998, almost 12 years now, it's now irrefutable. The measurements have been made. Explorations and crews have been sent out all over the world, and the data is in. Every single major glacier in the world is growing by a significant rate, and that can only happen with much colder, much more precipitous winters, where the snow packs upon itself and makes it very, very difficult for it to melt during the summer. Add to that the possibility of more particulate matter in the atmosphere, not only from volcanoes, but also from high-altitude clouds, which are generated by cosmic rays that come into our atmosphere. Mind you, not all of that comes from the sun, either. The solar wind has been kind of puny the last decade. And so the heliosphere is being overcome by the galactic wind, and the galactic wind carries all kinds of high-energy particles, the likes of which we have not seen in the history of man on this planet, or at least modern man. Maybe there have been many civilizations who have gone through it, but none that left any written record for us. As we reported last week, when we looked up the mission of the two Voyager craft as they left the heliosphere and entered the heliosheath, they expected to find the nice, quiet microwave hum left over from the Big Bang, and that is not what they found. What they found were pockets of high-energy particles neatly encapsulated in magnetic fields that nobody theorized would be there, and it was quite a surprise. So some of the cosmology is being rewritten as we speak. That being said, we are moving. Our whole solar system is moving through the galaxy. Earth, it's widely accepted, isn't from the Milky Way galaxy, probably from the Sagittarius galaxy, adopted millennia ago during a collision of the two galaxies. Needless to say, the solar system is not at rest. It's moving through the precession, all 12 signs of the zodiac, getting ready to begin the age of Aquarius. And that being said, we are nearing the band of what many cosmologists are saying is a very intense gravitational wave cluster or layer that's emitted by a supermassive spinning black hole in the center of the galaxy. In meeting with Dr. Fred Robb at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Hanford, Washington last year, my conversations with him, he divulged to me that they are aware of at least a change in the intensity in gravitational waves, although the LIGO, as they call it, makes sense for me to call it LIGO, but these are 4-kilometer-long concrete tubes that they evacuate all the air out of. It takes a couple of weeks to do that. And then they split a laser beam that's very, very carefully frequency controlled down those tubes, bounce it off of sapphire mirrors back to the source, and then tune those two beams against each other to interfere with each other to create what's called a null spot, a dark spot. That's why it's called an interferometer. Anyway, at 4 kilometers long per pass, and this makes several passes back and forth between the source mirror and the reflecting mirror, to create a beam about 20,000 miles long. That's a long, long, very sensitive ruler that can sense a vibration, a fraction of a proton in amplitude. They still have not directly detected a black hole. They have detected coalescing neutron stars, which is a feat in and of itself, and at least proves that neutron stars are rippling space-time, as Einstein had predicted. And we can corroborate the location of these coalescing neutron stars with radio telescopes in Arizona. So we know that LIGO, or LIGO, is working. However, it is designed to sense differences. It is not capable of being zeroed out. If we are in the midst of a large, long wave, perhaps one-tenth of a cycle per second or even longer than that, gravitational wave, it's very difficult to sense. There are three observatories that are working in tandem with each other. It is difficult to get each one online. Sometimes it takes weeks to get them online and get them stable. There are variations in the frequency generator. There are air leaks in the tubes. There are problems with the mirrors. And then they have to corroborate real-time all three observatories together because there are various special causes like trucks driving by and earthquakes and waves and wind and thunder. The nice thing is with three of them in three separate places, one in Washington, one in Louisiana, one in Australia, the chances of special causes occurring in all three locations simultaneously is very, very small. So they can throw these out. If they get a vibration in Washington that they don't get in Louisiana and Australia, then they throw out that data. But if it shows up in all three, then we know that it's extraterrestrial and it is legitimate to read. Now, you consider that there are sizable teams, not very well paid at that, working at each location, and it takes weeks to bring them online and a fair amount of money to keep them stable and going. The odds of all three running at the same time, as you might expect, are small. So they don't really get big windows of observation. And now they're down to something like 10 to the minus 23rd negative centimeters in sensitivity, which is very sensitive. So anything at all will cause a vibration. And so that's the challenge. They are meeting it, and they are making some incredible discoveries, like particles popping in and out of our dimension from another dimension. And they don't have a source for that dimension, but they do see energy showing up, or at least collapsing out of waves into particles and being detected rather spontaneously and without special cause. So it's going to take several years to digest, understand, and report on what they've already learned. And as we get closer to this band of very intense gravitational waves coming from the center of the galaxy, that's going to be perhaps decades before we understand. Of course, it would be nice to have it more real time, and they realize this too. So the budgets are being increased, and they're working as fast as they can. We expect by October of this year, all three of them should be running at the same time, and we're still waiting for LISA to be launched. That's the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. And this they can place much further apart than 4 kilometers, and they don't have to evacuate the particles from tubes. They can just line up the mirrors with great care, stabilize them, and turn it on, and it should give them a great sensitivity. It hasn't been launched yet, but we're looking for them to do that perhaps this year or next year. That being said, we're watching all of this, and it brings me to the next subject that we want to talk about tonight. And by the way, if you want to be part of the program, it's 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. The reason I brought this up, the reason I want to talk about gravitational waves, is there is some arm wrestling going on, as it were, out in the conspiracy theory community. Those who are perhaps in the know, or at least suspicious of what HARP can do, that's the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project on the North Slope of Alaska. The Russians have one, the Chinese have one, and there's rumor of another NATO HARP somewhere out there. that these high energy phased arrays, just to give you an idea what a phased array is, it's sort of like a whole bunch of clotheslines in a 380-acre vacant lot. That's what they look like. However, they do transmit a little over a billion watts of high-frequency radiation in a focused way straight up into the ionosphere. Now, it can be shaped a little bit electromagnetically. It can be pulsed, and it is in the 2-meter band, that is to say between 140 and 150 megahertz. That used to be the old ham band years ago when antennas were very long. Now we play around with 440 and 880. Cell phones are up around there as well. The dangers are that this frequency also energizes and resonates with a high energy radicals, free radicals like ozone and other free radicals up in the ionosphere. Now, the ionosphere is 30 to 80 kilometers up, and it varies depending on what the magnetics are doing around the planet. Sometimes it's very low, and AM does not bounce off it very easily. This we know as the Marconi effect. Remember Marconi trying to make a transatlantic radio broadcast? Had to wait for the right ionospheric conditions in order to get the wave to bounce across to over the horizon to Europe. Now, with HARP, we can artificially manipulate the ionosphere, forming a giant parabolic mirror, and then we can aim at different parts in that mirror ELF waves, which are extremely low-frequency waves, some in the audio band around 600 hertz, some lower than that, a little lower than what you can make with your voice, and some in the ultra-low frequencies down around 10 or 7 or even 4 hertz. The Russian model in the early days was called the woodpecker because when you were tuned into the frequency, you could hear the ELF wave ticking like a woodpecker pecking against a wooden telephone pole or a tree. I don't think they do telephone poles, not with creosote. My bad. Anyway, the idea is that the ELF waves were used to, in the early days, to send coded messages to submarines. It would trail a wire in the water and receive coded, encrypted messages, and then they would go back down and perform whatever mission they'd been ordered to do. They discovered all kinds of neat side effects with that. They found that with the right frequencies and the right intensity, that is the right volume, they could even affect the human mind. And as I inadvertently discovered in the late 80s, or mid-80s actually, in Oregon, you can induce an earthquake. And it's out there. So those of you, we're going to cover the Icelandic volcano for about the next 20 minutes, and I want to play for you. This is Dr. Rauni Kilde. She's commenting on the Iceland volcano. She is an official. This is probably going to bring the house down, but I'm going to play it anyway. Many of you have not heard it. I just recently posted it on the Facebook. And I'm going to play this for you. It's about 10 minutes. If you miss something, no problem. Just go back to the archives at xsquaredradio.com or bbsradio.com, whichever one you're subscribed to, and listen to it again. Keep in mind, English is not her her primary tongue, so it's a little halting, but hang in there. I think you'll enjoy it.
Dr. Rauni, we have had some extra days here because of the volcanic activity on Iceland. So we have had a lot of time to reflect and to research and to study and to feel and whatever. So it's actually been quite good. We are just between, we can say, Iceland and Europe. So all the ashes should have been coming this way, actually, what they say. What do you think about this? Is it as a kind of hoax, or are there some things that don't fit together, or what do you think?
Well, I've been surprised about some of the news, because first of all, I think it was fear they wanted to create, of course. And of course, it is normal in Iceland to have earthquakes. But somehow this earthquake, to me, seemed possibly as arranged, because that technology does exist. With HARP or with ASCOT in northern Norway, they can create earthquakes. Now, what would be the reason for it? And for me, it's a military exercise, because I don't think there are coincidences. And since in Germany, at the same time, they have an Air Force NATO exercise going on, was it from the 12th of April till the 22nd of April? And this happened on the 14th, so why? Of course, the Air Force needs to go through all kinds of weathers, and weather modification is just one of the means to fight so-called enemies. And people don't think that already, I think it was in the 77 or something, that the UN assembly was warning that weather should not be used as a weapon. And people in the street don't think that weather is an extreme weapon. If you can change the weather so that it comes, you can't see, it comes storms, it comes hurricanes, and earthquakes, or volcanoes erupt, man-made, that changes the war scenario. And I think they need to exercise, because of course military exercises. Now, this can't happen just by coincidence. If it is an exercise, a military exercise, the whole thing, then I would ask, who is able to give, quote-unquote, orders to the European traffic control? Because that has to be involved. If you think of the news that have been going on, so it's been a little bit surprising in my mind that some flights can go through the ashes and some, quote-unquote, can't. Now, they have been doing experimentation. The Finnish fighter pilots had no problems. Now, Lufthansa, Air Berlin, had been, and Lufthansa 10 times up there, and there has been nothing that would have affected their ability. Yet, just today, I read that an F-16 NATO fighter had gone through an ash cloud, and it must have been in Iceland in the beginning, because otherwise I don't understand the result. They did say that in the motor they found out a glass-like substance. And that's very, very serious in a military, not only exercise, but in the case of war. Somehow I can't leave the thought that this was a weather military Air Force, NATO Air Force exercise. And if you think that in next September 2010, in Finland, we're going to have the biggest Navy exercise ever in the country. And surprisingly, we're not members of the NATO. Surprisingly, all Northern European countries up to Netherlands are coming, including USA. From the southern point of near a small town above Turku, Obu, all the way almost to in our map, to Helsinki. Now, why are we having that?
Could that be, you say, preparation for, we know that they have sailed a lot of bombs to the ocean near Iran. It's like they're building up to strike Iran, and it has been going on for actually many years. It has been a subject that has been like a volcano. When is it going to blow off? But could this be preparation actually together with creating fear? Because, you know, every day people are talking about the planes are not flying, and it creates a subtle fear. Actually, everything to do with planes, you know, we had 9/11. So everything that has to do with an airplane ignites, you can say, a subtle fear on one level, even though people don't realize it.
I think that's exactly what could be happening, because already President Obama has been warning Iran very seriously. And I think it's just a question of time when America and NATO is going to attack Iran. And then the danger I see is possibly Russia goes with Iran. So maybe we don't just have a war in the Middle East, but it may be a third world war. And that's very, very serious and very scary to everybody. And totally, totally unnecessarily. But we must remember the elite, the powers that be, they want war because they gain economically. And if you think now of this situation in Europe with the Icelandic volcano, it seems that we're going to lose millions and millions in the air, normal commercial air traffic. So is there power that wants our euro to go down and wants an economic recession? That could be one of the reasons besides the normal quote military exercise. So we are in a transformation period, and it does look serious to me. What can we do? At least everybody who realizes what the situation is, they can start using their mind power. Mind power, don't attack Iran. Don't attack, you know, if everybody, millions would think that, their planes would just crash, or their guns wouldn't go off, because also, that energy is so powerful.
Also, you know, if the military people, they start to realize, you know, what they're part of. Many of them, they don't know if they're being used as pawns, you say, or like Henry Kissinger said, they're just stupid men used for international purposes. Politics.
Henry Kissinger said the military are useful idiots.
Yes.
And I don't accept that, because there are many, many good people in the military. And they always have to obey orders.
Yeah.
So we are in this situation now, but it's very interesting. Today, the first Icelandic air flight flew from Reykjavik to Helsinki. Not to Helsinki, to Tampere in Finland,
yes.
In middle Finland. So the air should be clear for anybody. If from Reykjavik you can fly, so you can fly from anywhere. So maybe this has been little hoax all over. And when they think that in the beginning there the winds went from the east, so how come they come to Europe, northern Europe, especially southern Norway and southern Sweden and downwards? Of course, on the other hand, Harp and Eiskat in north of Tromsø, with their antenna, huge weapons, they can steer the winds. They can steer them anyway, like they can even steer hurricanes, and they can cause them.
And that's very exciting when you say that, because they said on the Danish meteorologist, you know, the institute that comes with the weather tomorrow, the weather forecast and so, that the wind suddenly changed from coming from east to coming from northwest. But when you research a little about this, you will see that it's not completely true. And because the wind was still coming, and so it looked like we are having several winds coming from all kinds of direction at the same time. But what has been very positive about this situation since we've been together, we have just had, you know, it has been really sunshine and so, because where are all the chemtrails gone? But, you know, sometimes I've studied the weather a lot, so I've been out, you know, you have seen me being out there all the time with see what's going on. And some people, they have seen this harp activity. You can see it in the grid in the sky. It becomes like very mathematical, the lines in the sky and how they look. They're scalar clouds. They're very easy to spot because there's like a pattern going on. We have had this here as well. So it looks like perhaps a huge experiment, as you say.
It could be. In Germany, the American Air Force Base, which is responsible for Middle East, for instance, has been able to fly all the time. And, of course, they have to exercise how can their transporting flights go through ashes and whatever. And I think this is a perfect exercise.
The perfect exercise. So it does seem strange that while they're beginning a huge NATO air exercise, then the harp is used to excite the volcano, which, by the way, this place is, although subject to earthquakes, a lot of them, and I mean they're small, you know, 3, 3.5 on the Richter, they'll have 30 or 40 in a 24-hour period. That's really not even as active as Southern California, so nothing to really be alarmed about. But nevertheless, to be able to use a weapon system to excite an earthquake 60, 70 miles down that splits open the magma and causes a dormant volcano, been sitting there since 1821, and they couldn't have picked a better place for it to erupt. It erupted right underneath a glacier, which dumped hundreds of thousands of tons of ice into the magma, the lava, which normally would have just been like a Hawaiian eruption. It just would have flowed around and, you know, been red and angry for a while. But when it's pressured with steam from the glacier boiling rapidly as it begins to absorb the energy from the lava, it then creates an explosive effect, 1,000 times its size, and that's where you get this incredible launching effect to push these particles way, way, way up into the atmosphere. There are pictures of the ash being pushed well above the cloud shelf, which sits rather low up there because of the very cold temperatures. And they constantly have a wind up there being up way, way above the Arctic Circle. As they said, the wind changed direction, and it seemed mysteriously so because there were no fronts to push it. It was like something moved the ionosphere, which caused the jet stream to change with it. So I just want your opinion about it. You know, people are out there saying it's disingenuous to say, okay, we've had had a volcano, and so, gee, here come the harpers again. But, you know, there are some signatures. There are some telltale signs that seem to go with earthquakes and earth effects that line up with HAARP. One, of course, is the ham signature. And I have not seen any data on this yet, but it's early still. We're only talking the 14th, 15th of April, and now it's just now the 25th, so only 10 days. However, the auroras were there and are there still. The auroras are almost constant up in this area now. And, you know, the NATO exercise just wound down day before yesterday. And in a few weeks, they're getting ready to launch an even larger, more coordinated one. Not really sure why. It's hard to tell what they're doing down at Wars R Us. But I can tell you that somewhere in a manila envelope is a multinational scenario that has been all figured out down to the last gallon of JP-8. They know what resources they're going to expend. They know what they're hopefully going to learn. And believe me, they are watching everyone who is watching that. And they'll know when they move. Not unlike the rather rapid incursion of Israel into Lebanon. Meanwhile, every satellite in the free world was watching what Iran was doing, what they were shuffling about, and monitoring all the radio and cell phone and tomato can communications behind the scenes to see what was mobilizing. And we know also from past experience that there's a feint within a feint within a feint in the Middle East. However, it is also well known that the Arab world does not plan too well like that. So they react almost without thinking, and consequently expose themselves when things like this happen. And when that is the case, it does make complete tactical sense to try something like this and see what can happen. I guess the reason I wanted to broach this tonight is, you know, my involvement with Earth tomography in the early 80s, my development of ground probing radar, the many, many hundreds and hundreds of oil wells that we examined over more than a five-year period all over the United States, and 55 producing oil wells that we predicted successfully. We learn to use the frequencies. We learn to read the feedback and the distortions up from the strata below. And we weren't the only ones out there experimenting with it, although we were doing it with very low power. It's now being done with a lot of power, and that Earth tomography can go much, much further into the ground than we could ever go. Maybe our equipment could only go 3,500 feet. That's about it. But it was very accurate, very precise. And theirs obviously can go much further because it has a lot more power. And one of the things that you use when you're doing this is a method of triangulation, and you want to stay below 45 degrees on that angle because you have to take the tangent of that angle, and at 45 it becomes 1, and greater than 45 degrees, then the number becomes greater than 1, and your perspective is a little like trying to pinpoint a spot on the highway using your headlights as opposed to using a spotlight in the sky. You want a very shallow angle, a very acute angle, so less than 45 degrees. So that means if you're going to look deep into the earth, you've got to get back a long way, and you've got to have a lot of power. And then you've got to be able to receive that. So there may be satellites in the sky ready to receive that as they can get a giant triangle hundreds of miles along each leg and thus keep the angles very low and thus become very precise as far as the depth. And it's not so difficult to find these rifts, these fissures in the ground using it, because the distortions are really easy to pick up, especially in the audio band. Now, the interesting thing is that I have actually heard the broadcast of the harp signatures that the ham operators are picking up. Now, if it was just a blank, constant wave, you wouldn't hear anything. It would just be like tuning into a channel with no noise on it. You'd get nice signal strength, but there wouldn't be any noise on it. What you do hear in the harp signature is in the audio band. It's in the ELF band. So they are lacing it with frequencies. And the first time I heard it, I went, oh my gosh, that's exactly the sound that our equipment makes in the trailer. Of course, we're only using 100 watts, and still it was enough to evidently, apparently, trigger an earthquake in 1987. So I'm asking you, is this a harp signature above the volcano in Iceland? And do you think they're finished yet? 415-762-1161. The only reason I'm covering these conspiracy theories, and I'm trying to do it from a scientific point of view, not from a New World Order point of view, or not from any one individual country, is that's not what we do here. We don't talk about the negative, and we don't talk about, we just don't want to resonate that and keep it resonating out there in fear. What we do want to do, however, is keep you informed that something might be going on as the evidence is mounting. And if you, as Dr. Rowney said, maybe you want to get involved with your consciousness, as we have explained many times on this program, groups of minds that are put together in like thinking create an intention that has the effect of blending thousands, millions, and perhaps even billions of realities together, then the other realities just don't have a statistical chance of existing. And if you want to learn more about that, you can read the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And it's now out in ebook, Remember the Future book, RememberingTheFutureBook.com, RememberingTheFutureBook.com. And if you're in the Calgary area, the 13th through the 17th of May, you might want to go to Questers. Questers, it's in Calgary, Canada. You can get it at questers.ca, or you can click on the Questers banner at xsquaredradio.com. There are many fine speakers there. They are a curious lot up there in the sense that they have high curiosity, not in the sense that they're very strange three-eyed people. I'm sure not. But they've asked me to come up there and speak on the physics of the soul and time travel. And if you're in the area, or if you have your frequent flyer miles built up, you might want to take a jaunt northward and visit us during that weekend. Be happy to sign your books or DVDs or whatever. We have thousands of Canadians that have purchased our books over the last 5 years. And I will be bringing some books with me, not too many because of the weight limit on the plane, and it's prohibitively expensive to ship them from the publisher. However, we will have a setup there where you can order the books while you're there, and we'll make sure that they come autographed, and we'll make sure that you get the audio books while you're waiting, so you don't have to wait too long for the information. The audio books are about 45 hours of reading, so there's a lot to listen to. You can put it on your iPod or your MP3 player, or even burn it to a DVD or CD and play it in your car if you're so equipped. In the meantime, your order will be quickly processing in our Tennessee warehouse and shipping up to you. And we're excited about the information. We want to get it out there as much as we can. If you're not going to make it to Questers, and that's the 13th through the 17th of May, then we would like to see you at the ESETI conference. This is the Earth Transformation Conference, and this will be the July 4th weekend in Trout Lake, Washington. You can find out more about that by going to ESETI.org. It's around $300. Bring a tent. It's the hottest UFO activity in the country. I've been there several years and never been disappointed. I have photographed them in the day, in the night, as have dozens of other people. You can easily go to the site and find all kinds of information. And if you want corroboration from me, I still have the photographs I took on my hard drive here. I would be more than happy to share them with you, but I would be even more overjoyed to meet you in person up there. And that'll be the July 4th weekend. We usually go up there around Thursday and stay till the day after on Monday just to get some daytime photos after all of the energy and excitement is over. They seem to hang around, and there are going to be some energetic experiments up there. We're going to be building a frequency generator. Actually, it's a DC magnetic field generator. And it will be several million volts worth, and I believe over 5 million volts. It may be double that, 10 million volts. So we're going to try to set up in the field at the base of Mount Adams. Now, the last 2 years that we've done this, we did a rather small one, around 2 million volts. Last year did one almost 4 million volts with a huge number of people, about 125 people connected to it. And I'm telling you, the film, not just the movie, I mean, not just the still shots, but the movie film that was taken was absolutely filled with orbs, both invisible light and especially in infrared. It was unbelievable, like rivers, like oceans of orbs around us that came on with that energy and with the frivolity of the crowd. Come and join us up there at ESETI. James Gilliland and I and others will be up there to greet you. And if you want to find out more details on it, it's very easy. You can either click on the ESETI link at xsquaredradio.com or you can click on the As You Wish radio program at bbsradio.com and all the links are there. Or you can go to ECETI.org, ECETI.org. And we'll talk about that more in the coming weeks just to keep you primed. Our phone number tonight, 415-762-1161. In our next hour, we're going to move on from HARP. We've talked about detecting gravitational waves and the arm wrestling match between those who say it is the fact that our solar system is nearing a band of highly intense gravitational waves in a planar formation coming from the center of our galaxy that is responsible for the increased earthquake activity, increased rogue waves, increased volcanic activity. And there is another camp that believes and has some evidence in their camp that it is man-made activity that is responsible for tinkering with the energies of Mother Nature, trying to draft Mother Nature into the weapons world. That being said, in the last 7 or 8 minutes of this hour, I want to talk about the X-37B. Yesterday, the X-37B assumed orbit around the Earth. The X-37B was a smaller version of the space shuttle. It's about half the size, maybe a third the size of the space shuttle, and primarily because the cargo bay isn't nearly as big, and there are no accommodations for humans on board, so no need to store oxygen or spacesuits or food or exercise rooms or any such thing, and so it can be significantly smaller. Now, that being said, the X-37B was pretty much scrapped by NASA, out of money, no real focus for a mission for it. It was a nice idea. NASA had a full intention of conducting and increasing and carrying on a manned space program. However, about 5 years ago, the program became resurrected. It transferred from NASA to the Air Force. And the Air Force stuck the X-37B into the Rapid Deployment Program. Now, Rapid Deployment, when it comes to Air Force, means a blank checkbook. There is no tally on how much has been spent on the X-37B, this robotic, unmanned space shuttle that can go for a long-term flight in space. We're talking about 9 months in orbit, unmanned. The rapid deployment of the Air Force outfitted this thing, finished it, test flew it, and yesterday it went into orbit on an unnamed mission for an indeterminate amount of time. No one knows what's on board it. Everyone knows it was outfitted, designed, and launched by an unlimited budget by the U.S. Air Force. That's what we know. And we'll try to track it, but it is, as I said, much smaller than the space shuttle. It is not painted the same as the space shuttle. It's black instead of white. It will be difficult to track. It does have a solar array on it that it deploys in order to power itself. As far as I know, it does not have a nuclear source on it. If it has a solar array on it, it will roll over. And so eventually we will find it and track it for you and tell you where it is. Now, it's, I think, going to be a little higher orbit, maybe 280, 300 miles up. But nobody knows what it's up there for, and nobody knows what it's carrying. And we don't know if they've built another one. I suppose, why build one when you can build two for twice the price? As typical military faction fashion, according to M.R. Haddon from the movie Contact, just to bring you wonderful things like that. So I want you to pay attention, because in the next hour we're going to cover some politics and some demographics that are going to surprise you. So don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio in about 4.5 minutes. Just sit back, relax, enjoy our musical break. We'll be back after this. talk to aliens, warns Stephen Hawking. Hawking has depicted what kinds of aliens could be out there. The aliens are out there, and Earth had better watch out, at least according to Stephen Hawking. He has suggested that extraterrestrials are almost certain to exist, but that instead of seeking them out, humanity should be doing all that it can to avoid any contact. The suggestions come in a new documentary series in which Hawking, one of the world's leading scientists, will set out his latest thinking on some of the universe's greatest mysteries. Alien life, he will suggest, is almost certain to exist in many other parts of the universe, not just in planets, but perhaps in the center of stars, or even floating in interplanetary space. Hawking's logic on aliens is, for him, unusually simple. The universe, he points out, has 100 billion galaxies, each containing hundreds of millions of stars. In such a big place, Earth is unlikely to be the only planet where life has evolved. Quote, to my mathematical brain, the numbers alone make thinking about aliens perfectly rational, close quote, he said. The real challenge is to work out what aliens might actually be like. The answer, he suggests, is that most of it will be the equivalent of microbes or simple animals, the sort of life that has dominated Earth for most of its history. One scene in his documentary for the Discovery Channel shows herds of two-legged herbivores browsing on an alien cliff face where they are picked off by flying yellow lizard-like predators. Another shows glowing fluorescent aquatic animals forming vast shoals in the oceans thought to underlie the thick ice coating of Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. Such scenes are speculative, but Hawking uses them to lead on to a serious point, that a few life forms could be intelligent and pose a threat. Hawking believes that contact with such a species could be devastating for humanity. He suggests that aliens might simply raid Earth for its resources and then move on. He says, we only have to look at ourselves to see how intelligent life might develop into something we wouldn't want to meet. I imagine they might exist in massive ships, having used up all the resources from their home planet. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach. He concludes that trying to make contact with alien races is a little too risky. He said, if aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans. The completion of the documentary marks a triumph for Hawking, now 68, who is paralyzed by motor neuron disease and has very limited powers of communication. The project took him and his producers 3 years, during which he insisted on rewriting large chunks of the script and checking the filming. John Smithson, executive producer for Discovery, said he wanted to make a program that was entertaining for a general audience as well as scientific, and that's a tough job, given the complexity of the ideas involved. I know exactly what he means. We do that every week here on X Squared Radio. Hawking has suggested the possibility of alien life before, but his views have been clarified by a series of scientific breakthroughs, such as the discovery since 1995 of more than 450 planets orbiting distant stars, showing that planets are a common phenomenon. So far, all the new planets have been found have been much larger than Earth, but only because the telescopes used to detect them are not sensitive enough to detect Earth-sized bodies at such distances. I guess that's good for us. It's just as hard to detect us from that distance. Another breakthrough is the discovery that life on Earth has proven able to colonize its most extreme environments. If life can survive and evolve there, scientists reason, then perhaps nowhere is out of bounds. We often say on this program that if there is a void inside the Earth, there will be life there. Hawking's belief in aliens places him in good scientific company. In his recent Wonders of the Solar System BBC series, Professor Brian Cox backed the idea too, suggesting Mars, Europa, and Titan, a moon of Saturn, as likely places to look. Similarly, Lord Rees, the Astronomer Royal, warned in a lecture earlier this year that aliens might prove to be beyond human understanding. I suspect there could be life and intelligence out there in forms we can't conceive, he said. Just as a chimpanzee can't understand quantum theory, it could be that there are aspects of reality that are beyond the capacity of our brains. Well, speak for yourself, Lord Rees. So I want your opinion on that. If you think that we're treading on dangerous waters, going out in the middle of the desert with our laser lights and our consciousness open, courting the contact with aliens, 415-762-1161. If you've had contact or known someone who has had contact with aliens, was there fear involved? Was it an abduction experience, or was it benevolent? Was there learning? Was there some kind of transfer? And do you trust them? Interesting to think about. Do you trust them? Well, it's hard enough to trust our own kind, let alone another, and we're naturally a suspicious people anyway. And given our official activities here on the Earth, we probably will not be in our best behavior when we do make official contact. And I guess we need to only go back to the early settlers to see how they treated intelligent life when they found it. And if they're more technologically advanced than we are and can tread through our airspace with impunity, I imagine that it will be even more difficult to trust them. So, do we have any plans to not live up to the fears of the world's greatest minds? Or do you think we're up to it? 415-762-1161, if you've got an opinion on that. Now, in this hour, I wanted to cover something that the conspiracy theories are beginning to fly about. It hasn't been that long, and we're sort of letting it settle out a little bit. But, you know, we don't want to let things rest too long because we don't want to be scooped. So we're going to cover a recent plane disaster that has some very far-reaching ramifications. This is the Polish plane crash conspiracy. Whisper it quietly, but the Polish plane crash conspiracy theories have already begun to surface. No one dared to mention their feelings out loud, but a few days after the tragic plane crash, murmurings are starting to be heard, questioning the events of the Polish president plane crash. The conspiracy has found a base, given the enormity of the event, with so many top-ranking officials perishing on the flight. Poles have openly questioned just who's allowed so many of the country's top brass to travel on the same flight. That sounds like poor judgment. Many corporations do not allow their executives to fly on the same commercial flights, let alone private flights. We had a disaster in the electric car industry just recently, as Tesla's main executives died in a small plane crash as they were beginning to put together the last pieces for their initial public offering, which was really being looked at heavily, especially by the electric car industry, because Tesla, although not really a practical car for the people, it is a breakthrough. It is an independent coming forward and making an electric vehicle accessible to the public. And it was rumored that their public offering was going to be a record breaker, possibly because Tesla has had really unprecedented press coverage. And even though not all of it was positive, it was always progressive. They were always moving forward, whether it was through the innovation of their inventions or the drive and ego of their leader, it remains to be seen. And it may make no difference in the end, because they changed history, and for that they should be commended. However, when we look at how poor judgment it really is to put, and I'm going to give you the list of top-level people who died on this plane, because I don't know if you've really heard it. I think you heard, oh yeah, a bunch of top people were on a plane and it went down, and it was pilot error, blah, 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 blah. But you can't really listen to the news and believe them. I have been in foreign countries standing at the spot they were reporting on and looked around myself and said, what the heck are they talking about? I'm standing here right now and I'm telling you, that's not happening. Whatever it is they're reporting on the news is a lie. And I wouldn't have believed it, except I was there, and I saw it with my own eyes. So here you go. Now, it might be a little struggle for me. I pray that it will be less of a struggle for you. Here's the list of top-level people who died. Lech Kaczynski, President of the Republic of Poland. General Tadeusz Buk, Head of Polish Land Forces. Katarzyna Dorożyńska, President's Chancellery. General Franciszek Gagor, Chief of Staff. Admiral Andrzej Karweta, Head of Polish Navy. Mariusz Kaczana, Foreign Ministry. Stanisław Jerzy-Komorowski, Deputy Defense Minister. Andrzej Kremer, Deputy Foreign Minister. Tomasz Merta, Deputy Culture Minister. Tomasz Merta, oh, I just said that. Krzysztof Putra, Deputy Speaker of Parliament. Sławomir Skuczbek, Head of Poland's Central Bank. Alexander Szyczko, Head of National Security Bureau, and Izabela Tomaszewska, President's Chancellery. Now, this is a sizable chunk of the cabinet. The Deputy Foreign Minister, the Head of the Polish Central Bank, Polish Land Forces Chief of Staff. This is unheard of. Now, you're going to hear the rest of the details. For Poland, still coming to terms with the disaster, onlookers have started to look at just who will fill the political vacuum left by the plane crash. Were the newly appointed figures to be aligned with Donald Tusk's party there? Could be rumblings of discontent that maybe this was a very effective way to stage a coup. You know, a coup d'etat. Of course, for the Poles, suspicion of Russia will always be their first go-to idea. But in this case, it seems incredibly unlikely that the Kremlin and or Putin had anything to do with it. You see, Vladimir Putin was on the runway to see off President Lech Kaczynski when the late president's body was returned to Poland, and it is fanciful to believe that heads of state would be involved in the assassination of other heads of state. It is rather chilling to think that Vladimir Putin shook the president's hand and his wife's hand as they boarded the plane and headed into the fog of Russia. But still, there is disquiet among the people concerning the last actions of the pilot, with varying stories relating to his decisions. You know, a pilot is a pilot, and when you're flying the president's plane, who do you think you take orders from? There is talk that he was told to land at the Smolensk airport by his Polish president's entourage, regardless of the treacherous conditions. And there is another theory that the pilot's grasp of Russian was so bad he couldn't understand the Russian air traffic controller's directions. Whatever the case, until the truth is known about the event, the Polish plane crash conspiracy theories will only continue to grow. Russian investigators have ruled out technical faults as the cause of the air crash, which killed 96 people, not just the heads of state that I named for you, including the Polish president, and appeared to blame the Polish pilots for the tragedy. However, questions were being asked last night about why a roll call of Poland's influential politicians and military chiefs were allowed to travel on the same, and this is a Tu-154. Russians had withdrawn its Tu-154 fleet, the workhorse of Eastern Bloc civil aviation, in the 1970s and 80s. That would be 30 to 20 years ago. And those planes were way, way over half-time airplanes. They may have been three-quarter-time airplanes or even used up. But the Russians withdrew them from service because the planes are expensive on fuel and do not meet the international noise restrictions. In other words, they don't have hush kits on them. They're loud airplanes. While there have been 66 crashes involving the planes in the last four decades, Poland has not retired the airplane because of cost. The presidential plane was fully overhauled in December. That would be what's called a D-check. This is where they take the skin off the airplane, they check the airframe, they change the hydraulic lines, the valves, the solenoids, they change out the wiring. A D-check is a complete rebuild from the frame out. It is a really big deal. New engines or rebuilt engines, rotables they call them. It's a D-check. So you can keep a very old airplane in very, very top shape. That being said, it's the president's plane. Surely he could have upgraded to something like a 737, which is a small plane, but easily, they can easily carry 96 people. A 737 can carry well over 110 people. Or even a stretched MD-88, McDonnell Douglas. They carry almost 173 people, so surely they could have upgraded. I guess what remains is a careful watch over who replaces these men and women and what Poland was flying to Russia to accomplish. Why were they going in the first place? What was the mission? Well, they weren't going up there for spring break. They would, if encountering poor weather, and if they weren't really determined to get there, they would have just turned around and flown home. Instead, they landed in heavy fog. Now, that being said, the planes are equipped with ALS. They are have an automated landing system, so they can go all the way to the runway with no hands on the stick. Not a problem. This is an area that's plagued by fog all the time. If you've ever flown into I can't remember the name of the city that I flew into in Germany. Anyway, it's interesting because you're flying around up there in a holding pattern, and the whole area is covered with clouds. And then one plane at a time, you just sort of descend through the clouds, and you go with zero, I mean zero visibility until you just break through and there's the runway. And it's that way virtually all year round up there. So it's... They're used to flying in that kind of weather. Yes, of course, it was foggy, but these pilots, especially if he was the pilot of the presidential plane, is well, well experienced on being able to land in that kind of weather and take off in that kind of weather. It's done all the time. Now, if the Russians were involved and Putin knew anything about it, it seems particularly cold-blooded, as I said, to shake their hands before they take off. So it remains to be seen what's going on over there. What were they doing? Were they changing out some bonds? Were they making a money deal? Were they making an oil deal? Was it some kind of NATO thing? This was a lot of heads of state. There should have been three airplanes, and usually there are in U.S. operations. You have two 747s to fly. One has the press crew on it, and usually the lesser heads of state, congressmen, aides, stuff like that, fly on that plane, and then the president flies on his own plane, and then there's another plane for a defense class or staff class people. Three aircraft all the time, and they all have escorts. So, interesting to see how that can happen. Your ideas on that? I admit it hasn't been much time, but enough time that, you know, we can sort of sift through the conspiracy theories and not get too excited about different motivations, but certainly suspicion that too many people in one place. As we used to say when we were in the service, one bomb would get us all. We need to scatter, boys. You stand over there, we stand over here, we'll talk by phone, but we're not going to stand together, not here. So, your ideas on that. 415-762-1161. I'm Brooks Agnew. We're here on X Squared Radio, coming to you live from North Carolina tonight. Next month, the 13th through the 17th, I'll be at the Questers Conference in Calgary, Canada, if you're in the area. Have some leftover frequent flyer miles you need to get rid of, or a voucher of some kind, why don't you make your way up there? It could be a pretty exciting conference if you've never been to Calgary. If you can't make it up there, then perhaps you can make it to Trout Lake, Washington, up in the Northwest this July. Should have some kind of summer up there. It'll be in the mid-80s during the day and down in the low 50s, perhaps high 40s at night. It's not too high up in the mountains, but we do have a fantastic, breathtaking view of Mount Adams. If you want to find out more about it, go to eseti.org, E-E-C-E-T-I.org, or click on the eSETI link at X Squared Radio, or go to listen to bbsradio.com to As You Wish Radio with James Gilliland, and you can learn more about that. It's coming up, so it's not much. It's around $300 for the whole thing. Bring a tent. I promise you, if you ever had a desire to see a UFO, you should come. We're going to run some experiments. They're going to be pretty exciting, so you should partake. Great speakers. It's a great time. You won't leave with a workshop high. You will probably leave with a life change. Make your way up there and check it out. Those are the two conferences coming up immediately. We do have an interview on the 28th with a radio program. It's an online radio, and they're having an event, One World Radio, and we don't want you to miss that. If you need a link to it, you can go to oneworldradio.com and check it out, or the links are on our Facebook as well. Just search for Brooks Agnew. All right, as we get closer to the bottom of the hour, I want to move into my third subject for tonight. We have tried to lay out for you some current events that are happening. Not to alarm you, but to keep you awake, to keep you aware of the things that are happening out there. And now we're going to let you know perhaps a little history lesson if you haven't had this history. I guarantee you're going to hear something here you've never heard before. The reason I know this is it was one of my theses, so you're going to hear about it in just a second. Hold on a moment while I pour something down my throat. Much better. Since you won't call in, I have to do all the talking, so we don't take commercial breaks here for an hour. So that means that you're getting three classroom quality lectures tonight. here on X Squared Radio, and I don't mind at all. It's just you and me here. So, you know, if you want to call, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine, too. If you want to send a message to me on Skype, I'm there at Brooks Agnew. It's easy to find. Now, this is 2010. It's an election year, and energies are mounting. In the United States, we have certainly swung the pendulum back and forth the last 20 years. It seems the American people are paying the price for this. And maybe rightfully so. It's hard to tell whether they're focused on it or whether it's a nuisance to them getting in the way of their paychecks. And maybe when it affects you with unemployment or affects you with high fuel prices, then you squawk a little bit. But I can also tell you that our public officials are not listening too well either. Their offices are getting lots of letters and lots of phone calls. I know this because I do speak to several of them. And some of them respond and some of them do not. Some of them are annoyed by it. It gets in the way of what it is they're about. And others are very sensitive to their constituents and do their best to help the local people. I do know that that people do complain to their legislators. I know up in West Virginia and Virginia, because of the recent coal mine accident, a lot is coming out. Hundreds and hundreds of violations, that have been made known to legislators up there, and yet, no crackdown, no regulations to help. And then sooner or later, enough safety violations and somebody's gonna pay. And unfortunately, in this case, it's always the man in the dark. So our condolences to those families up there, and also our thanks to them for continuing to bring us the fuel to provide us the electricity to run our industrial machine. That being said, we don't want to take anything away from that. There are a future of energy is moving in a different direction, and perhaps one day we won't have to make carbon dioxide in order to energize our planet. We'll be able to tap into things that are more clean and more renewable, and perhaps be more creative for jobs for those people who want to continue to work in the area of energy. And one has to wonder how we get into these conditions, how we make our way down this not-so-slippery slope, but it's certainly a slope. But before we get into that, let's listen to Ramon from New York. Welcome to the program, Ramon. Ramon, are you there? I know my producer said you're there, so you got to be there. We're not hearing Ramon. So if Seth is around the board, turn Ramon's volume up. No Ramon. Okay, well, Ramon will call back. Not a problem. So how do we get ourselves in this situation? When and what is this situation? Maybe I could be more clear about that. We feel, as the American people, like we have lost control of our government. You know, we are the governed, and government is supposed to exist and function by our consent. I don't know anybody that feels that way anymore. I really don't. I know that I speak to people around the country, and they use the word the government this and the government that. And not to be correcting, but I do make a point, not so energetically, but courteously as I can, that there really, in this country at least, there's no such thing as the government. There is a loose coalition of bureaucracies who are all fighting for the same budget. The bureaucrats last and outlast all the politicians. And I can tell you, as I have lunch with them and I sit and speak with them, they're as frustrated as you are because they cannot get anything out of the bureaucrats either. they call and they make mention of their concerns, and they are told that it should be none of their concern. It's none of their business. I was here when you got here, and I'll be here when you go home. And we also know that they have the power to run the presses. These different bureaucracies, if they have friends and those friends need money, why, they'll just print it. Well, you and I, we have to earn it. Unless, of course, you form a corporation and you print your own money in the form of stock. The trick is to convince somebody that your money is worth something. That's the struggle for a small business. Not so much the struggle for a nation. It used to really mean something when you would throw around the faith and credit of the United States of America. Not so much anymore. Not as much anymore. And that's why I want to discuss how maybe we got to this point. And maybe what it is we can do about it. We, the governed, the ones who are supposed to be consenting. Originally, and this is when the Constitution, our form of government, was originally drafted. You hear our forefathers affectionately brought up at the political opportune time, but you don't really hear them mentioned, or you don't hear them admitted to even existing when you try to really talk about what our brilliant forefathers had in mind when they set up this government, because Earth Explorers, they had been through this before. The House of Lords and House of Commons was around centuries and centuries before the United States ever became formed, and we had our problems with it. And we still have our problems, and the British people do too, and so does Scotland and Ireland as well. So they wrote rules and guidelines to make sure those things couldn't happen again. But still, a change here, a word here, an interpretation there, a court precedence here, and the right political rhetoric and the right political season, which can be carefully crafted, carefully over a decade, maybe a generation or two, you will accomplish what you want to accomplish. So what I'm about to describe to you is how we lost the United States. Originally, a senator was elected by the legislature of a state. That's right. Your state representatives, the guy that lives in your subdivision, the guy that goes to the state building and represents you, your neighborhood. He might work 3, 4, 5 months a year, depending on the budgetary requirements of the state. In Kentucky, it's a few months a year. In California, it's perhaps a little longer than that. But it's the local guy, almost risen from the city council, and then the county commission, and then he makes his way to the state legislature. These are the guys that elected a senator and sent him to Washington. And he was expected to represent the state government within the federal government. This was expected to help keep the balance between federal and state authority. Although it was believed that while on an unqualified candidate, you know, he might win a popular vote majority through demagoguery or superficial qualities, whereas the legislature, which could deliberate on its choice, and they could argue, and they could debate, and whose members had been selected by their constituents, and had experience in politics, and also were accountable to the people in their own neighborhood, that they would be safe from such folly. Finally, election by the legislature was expected to insulate senators from the distraction of public campaigning for election or re-election, leaving them free to concentrate on the great business of the federal government. This last purpose was also served by the 6-year term for senators, compared to the 2-year term for U.S. representatives. I know many of you didn't know that. Congressmen have to run for election every single 2 years. The instant the election is over, they must begin campaigning again, raising money again, because in 24 months, actually less than 24 months, they have to run again. And that's how these congressional dynasties are built, because they build a political machine that's constantly raising money, constantly keeping track of any competitors that might be up and coming in their party and in other parties. They also make sure that they outspend and also use the power of the incumbency, which gives them access to federal ability to spread, and also access to the bully pulpit, not so much like the president, but a congressman can get in front of the press, especially if they're sponsoring a bill or opposing something or supporting something that the president might be doing. The Senate, however, was different. Election by legislatures generally occurred without major problems up to the mid-1850s. Reform efforts began as early as 1826, when direct election was first proposed. In the 1870s, citizens petitioned the House of Representatives for direct election. From 1893 to 1902, support for direct election increased considerably. Each year, during that period, a constitutional amendment for direct election was proposed in Congress, but the Senate rejected it. In the mid-1890s, the Populist Party put direct election of senators in its platform, but neither the Democrats nor the Republicans paid much notice at the time. Now, this is going to be interesting to you, because I'm going to show you something that really happened. By 1896, now this is well after the Civil War, by 1896, the Democratic Party took up many of the People's Party's causes at the national level, and the party began to fade from national prominence. In that year's election, the populists nominated a Democratic candidate named William Jennings Bryan. Now, he was quite the orator. He was quite the dashing man. Something was missing in him, though. Something behind the curtain that people couldn't figure out. He backed the populist opposition to the gold standard in his famous Cross of Gold speech. He wanted the silver standard. He thought that silver was the key to American money and should not be removed. Populists could not bring themselves to also nominate Bryan's conservative Eastern running mate, Arthur Sewall, and nominated instead Thomas E. Watson for vice president. Though Watson had previously expressed some opposition to fusion with the Democrats, Watson was cautiously open to cooperation, but after the election would recant any hope he had and the possibility of cooperation as a viable tool. In the 1896 convention, at the Coliseum of the St. Louis Exposition and Music Hall, which in the same month hosted the 1896 Republican National Convention, Bryan lost to William McKinley by a margin of only 600,000 votes. Now, that was close. Now I'm going to tell you how this all relates, at least to the populist movement and to what we today still call the Wizard of Oz. You see, Frank L. Baum, the person who actually wrote the Wizard of Oz, wrote it as a satire of this election. William Jennings Bryant was actually portrayed by the Cowardly Lion. And it was kind of interesting how it worked. And the situation of the wizard behind the curtain, pulling all the handles and making all the grandstanding, but not really that powerful himself, also a character in this situation. The Tin Man represented industry, the straw man, farmers. And so as you put all the pieces together, you realize that it was all written as a satire to this political event. And by the way, the slippers that Dorothy wore in the book, they weren't ruby. They were silver. That's right. Click your heels together three times, and it will take you home. The silver slippers. Don't go off the silver standard. Popular support of senatorial election reform grew rapidly at this time. In 1905, William Randolph Hearst, you'll remember him, acquired Cosmopolitan. You know, Cosmo, then a general interest magazine. I think it's still generally interesting, and made it an advocate of direct election. By the way, William Randolph Hearst also introduced a concept we still call yellow journalism. You'll remember that the U.S. had a ship that was at sea, actually parked. I'm going to tell you the story. You know, Hearst was not selling very many newspapers at this time. Times were kind of slow. Come on, there really hadn't been a war in a while, and he needed to sell some papers. So he basically said, you give me a picture and I'll give you a war. And sure enough, one of the American steamships had a boiler accident. A boiler accident. And they happened to be in Spanish territory. Sure enough, William Randolph Hearst published the article with the picture of the ship in flames and started the Spanish-American War. We sunk the Spanish fleet in their own waters. Thank you, William Randolph Hearst. Anyway, in 1906, Cosmopolitan published The Treason of the Senate, a series of scathing articles by muckraking reporter David Graham Phillips, which describes senators as corrupt pawns of industrialists and financiers. Hey, wait a minute. That's what we call senators today. Well, in any case, true to his yellow journalism style, William Randolph Hearst changed history again. Increasingly, senators were elected based on state referenda, similar to the means developed by Oregon, and by 1912, as many as 29 states elected senators, either as nominees or party primaries in conjunction with general elections. Now, these were de facto elections. They weren't actually elected, but they would have elections on a state level in order to create their senators instead of going through the legislators. And sure enough, it didn't take long. By 1910, almost two-thirds of the states had called for such a convention, which put pressure on the Congress to propose the amendment and eliminate the need for the convention. And sure enough, on April 8, 1913, just before World War I, Connecticut became the 36th state out of 48 to ratify, and the 17th Amendment was adopted. Hold on one moment while we take a phone call. Oh, wait a minute. Not a phone call. It is a text. Oh, yeah. Okay, I will do that in just a second. They want me to critique authors of the new book, 2012 Secrets Unlocked. You'll finally learn the truth, you'll discover, blah, blah, blah. Okay, yes. We're definitely going to talk about that. Don't worry about that. But what I really want to get to you here is the 17th Amendment changed the way the founding fathers had in mind for the Senate to be elected. The Senate was used to be elected by the guy right down the street, your friendly neighborhood state representative, the guy that goes to the Hill in your state and pleads your neighborhood's case for sewer money and another school and, you know, dams and power lines and all that kind of stuff. That's the guy that would send the senator to Washington up until April 8th, 1913. Almost 100 years ago. What happened then is that the senators very rapidly, now able to run for election, had to accumulate their own bankrolls. And so they disconnected from the state. They disconnected from the state and they became federal electees. And many of these senatorial elections are no longer state elections. They're national elections. Why do I say that? Do you think the people of Ohio vote for a senator in Michigan? Do you think the people of New Mexico vote for a senator in California? You bet they do. With their money. With their money. Because these senators will bring in, especially if they're in a key committee or in a opposing party. Like right now, the Republicans do not control the Senate. The Democrats control the Senate. Don't think for one minute that states that currently have Democratic senators are not receiving money from states that have Republican senators in an attempt to give those Republican candidates enough budget to beat the incumbent Democrat senator in that state. It's happening. It happens in a big way, and it's no longer a couple of million dollars to run for Senate. It's a multi-million dollar campaign to run and win a Senate, especially in these big states like New York and California and Texas and Florida. These are states that really swing a lot of power. Even though there's only two senators, there's a lot of money and a lot of constituents behind that vote. The bottom line is, contrary to the founding fathers, the dynamics of the way the people are represented in the federal government has changed in the last 100 years. And we have people like William Randolph Hearst and his yellow journalism to thank for it. Now, we are an awakened and informed American public. And now we have a view of the future. And we can come back to the present and we can fix it by repealing the 17th Amendment and going back to local legislators appointing the senators. And then maybe these 24 and 30 year dynasties like lords in a House of Lords, moving with impunity, regardless of their personal lives, of their political or economic integrity, we can put the government back in the hands of the governed. We can at last tell the governing body that we are consenting to their rule over us. And they must rule by our consent. Now we, by very constitutional means, without violence, without chicanery, we, the people, take control and reform the government instead of a loose coalition of bureaucracies. Our number is 415-762-1161 if you'd like to join us. We're getting, this year we're going to develop a little bit more of the political angle. Not so much like you hear in the daytime talk radio, but from an analytical point of view so that you, the people, can feel that you are empowered. Because you are empowered. You can do something about it. There is nothing of hatred or negativity about this. There is positive outlook. There is hope like the founding fathers had for this nation when it was first founded. And that's what I want you to pay close attention to. And the reason that I want you to pay close attention to that is because it's time that the bureaucracies came back under the rule of civilian politicians. It is about time that generals once again answered to the leaders the people have put in place, and not the other way around. The Pentagon doesn't call up the president from Wars R Us and say, Mr. President, these are the things we need to do, and if you know what's good for you, you'll do them. And he hops too. I don't know if you feel the same way I do, but the actions of the current president, President Barack Obama, are quite a bit different than the rhetoric of his campaign. I think he really didn't know, because he didn't have a need to know. He was just a candidate. Now he's a president, and he knows. So he knows the neighborhood in which we live. He knows the neighbors that we have do not have our best interests in mind. Why? Because we don't have their best interests in mind. Interesting. Lots of things going on. You know, recently President Obama said that we would not respond with nuclear weapons no matter what. I kind of like that. I'll tell you why right after we take this phone call. Andrew from New York, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I tell you, you know, you're one of the few people I can listen to and actually, you know, really get the truth from, where, you know, I've, you know, recently embarked on the a constitutional study, and you explained the way the state Senate actually elects our federal senators beautifully, and I hope more people now realize how it was formed by the Founding Fathers.
Well, I appreciate that. I thank my college history teacher for teaching it to me that way. But then I actually wrote a couple papers for my graduate classes that kind of took me in a little different direction, and I've refined it over the years. And I see how, you know, the journalists of the day were really, you know, the billionaires of the day, and they were trying to manipulate things so that they could sell more papers, and they really needed a war, and William Randolph Hearst was one of the worst culprits. We laugh about it now, but my goodness, lots and lots of lives were lost because of that.
Yes, that is so true. Amongst other things that, you know, his propaganda machine pushed.
Well, in those days, people got their news from the paper, and Hearst was the papers. I mean, that's, you know, he was like Comcast, you know, was of today. If you got the news, you got it from Hearst. There was no news at 11 back then. There was no Fox News, and there certainly wasn't an internet. And the internet really, I want to get your ideas on this, Andrew, because the internet really is kind of uncontrolled free press. Now, there's a lot of junk out there, but we can sift through it. But there are a lot of facts, too, and if you're intelligent enough to put the facts together, you get a pretty clear picture pretty quickly, don't you think?
Oh, I do. And that's one of the strongholds of the Internet, is that as long as we keep it free and clear of any bureaucracy, I think, you know, like you said, you sift through the nonsense, and you see what resonates well with you. And if you do your proper research and your due diligence on looking into situations and certain aspects of the news, you could see what is true and what is false. And I believe, I didn't think when it was, you know, put together, this whole internet thing, I thought it was more, I think that people thought that it would be more control thing on other people, where now the freedom of information, it goes all around the world. So, you know, we actually have a handle on what really happening, let's say, in Iceland with the volcanic, you know, eruptions, or what's happening in Russia and Germany and Italy and Greece, you know, and I don't, you know, when people actually go to the internet for their news more than, you know, the mainstream media.
Well, you know, for a couple hundred years, actually maybe 300 years, the press is what has kept this nation free. It's that politicians cannot act with impunity. There's always a reporter there snapping a picture or making an interview or witnessing something. Now we have, you know, cell phone to Facebook to internet within a matter of seconds. So you can't get away with anything. There's no sneaking around anymore. You have to be a man of integrity. And I don't know that the integrity needs to go back to the time of your birth. I think that you probably can have a couple skeletons in the closet as long as you say, hey, I have a couple skeletons in my closet, but I've been elected by the people and I want to go do the best job I can. Then people will say, fine. Hey, the guy admitted he had a couple skeletons and let's let him have a go. He's one of us.
Right.
The press has always kept us free is my point. And the instant that we start truncating or censoring the press, we allow those who would hide in secret behind that censure to operate with impunity. And I think the internet is really the ultimate free press.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it was less than, 80 years ago that there were more than 100 independently owned and operated, whether it be the newspaper and or your radio stations. And now it's only 6 in the United States, from what I understand.
Well, actually, it was close to 695 separate radio markets, and then they got drawn under national, well, not really national, but I'll say very, very broad corporate ownership. And the reason is that local radio stations really needed national advertisements in order to round out their dollars. I mean, at the top of the hour, there's about 11 and a half minutes of national ads, things that would sell all over the country that are available in a local market in say Morristown, Tennessee, a town of 14 or 15,000 people. But those national dollars buying that time on that local radio station keeps it in business. And it just couldn't make it on local revenue because people will only pay $2 for a 60-second spot. But a national will pay quite a bit more. And, of course, you lower your administrative costs by having central programming feeds and things like that. So it was just economics for it to happen. But that being said, you lose the ability to interpret the news for yourself. You're forced to just take the feed and play it.
Right. Yeah, it loses its independence.
Right. It's kind of like school boards. And I think it's only a matter of time before the school boards fall to the same thing. Right now, they're quite protected by legislation, but there have been things like Education Edge and Goals 2000, which were implemented by Clinton and then Bush, which really are trying to take national control of local school boards. And really, Andrew, it extends out to homeschoolers as well. It's not so much that they want to provide resources for the homeschoolers as they want to bring the homeschoolers under the auspices of that school board and that district.
Right. Yeah, I'm not too familiar with that, but, and like you said, it's protected by legislation. I know that because I've been to a couple of school board meetings.
Right. Well, it's also protected by a plethora of papers written by Jefferson and Hamilton, who really said that the schools really needed to be separate from national government. State government's okay. I'll give you a couple of points here. When a local school board gets together and, for instance, decides what textbooks are going to be in the local high schools, they go to the different trade shows and they talk to Rand McNally and they talk to all the textbook suppliers out there, and they look at the one that fits their ideology the best, their state history the best, and that's the one they select. And there might be 30 different history books out there. There might be 25 different English books, and I don't know how many math books. So there's a competition. The reason they do this is because every state has a standardized exam, and they want textbooks that will best prepare their students for the standardized state exam. Because so the school students do on that test, it governs how much money the school's going to get. But the game changes when it goes federal. Because when it goes federal, there's only one exam, and there's only one set of textbooks that matches the exam the best, and the competition goes away. And that is bad for freedom.
Yeah, that's very bad. Because it's the lobbyist with the biggest pockets is going to win that.
Well, sure, or the one that's made legal, the one that's federally endorsed, you know, that's the one that's going to be distributing all the history books to all the history classes in the whole country. And I'll tell you when this really makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. When I walked into my third grader's classroom to volunteer and help that day, I saw on the chalkboard, written by the teacher, President Lincoln fought the Civil War to free the slaves.
Oh,
I said, well, who put that on the board? She said, I did. I said, well, where did that come from? She said, out of our textbook. I said, look, you're only about 25 years old, but that's not true. You're teaching that to third graders. They don't really care. But I'm telling you, that's not why the Civil War was fought. Who said that? Well, that was what was approved by that school board. As controversial as it might be, that could be the federal outlook.
Right. And that's scary.
Sure it is. And that's just a small example. I don't think you would have ever heard that about William Randolph Hearst from the federal point of view either. But it's true.
Oh, no.
What happened.
No. Although there was a movie made about him, wasn't there?
Oh, several, yeah. And
from
the black and white ones all the way up to the color ones, they're quite amazing. So where are you going to college out there?
No, actually, I work in the engineering field.
Oh, great. What field of engineering?
It's the refrigeration, air conditioning, and heating.
Excellent. Boy, there's sure need of that in New York.
Yeah.
There will never be a surplus of HVAC mechanical guys, I'll tell you. There's a lot to science.
No, they haven't built a robot that can do what we could do yet.
No, that's right. That's excellent. And that's great. I mean, that's what makes our planet livable. You know, people say, well, yeah, we live on the surface of Earth. And I say, really? You know, the average person spends less than 15% of their time outdoors?
Yeah. 50% now, right? So you have to be, the air has to be conditioned.
Yep. Well, we can't dress the way we want to dress and have a nice, hot, humid New York afternoon, can we?
No. Well, I'm blessed to live close to the beach, so I do enjoy those hot afternoons.
Yeah, that's not so bad when you're close in there. But when you're in the city on the 25th floor and you can't open any windows in that building, yeah, you got to have HVAC.
Yeah. That's when a guy like me comes in handy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you'll have a job for life, no question about that. Yep. All right, Andrew, I really appreciate the call. Thanks for the comments. Nice to have you on.
Okay, and thanks, Dr. Agnew. Keep spreading the good word.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Earth Explorers. We're going to go into a little bit more of 2012 and what some people are saying about it, what you can do about it. How is it affecting your life? And I've got a lot of questions that have been sent in during the last hour by Skypers, and that's okay. Keep sending them. I'm at Brooks Agnew, easy to find on Skype. And or you can always call 415-762-1161. No problems. Happy to have you on the program, and we'll discuss anything. We discuss the Founding Fathers and what they had in mind for our form of government, which is now, unfortunately, just a loose coalition of bureaucracies. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
The Alice Band, a cappella after the Gold Rush, a Neil Young song. I like the way they do it because they're talking about the 21st century, Mother Nature on the run. During our last hour, we talked about several political issues, not so much commentary in the sense that, you know, I'm mad at anybody or want anybody to lose perspective of anything. But I do want you to know what happened, why we ended up where we are. And it hasn't been that long, barely 100 years. Barely your grandparents out of the picture. Perhaps your great-grandparents were there. Mine were born in 1900. So this kind of stuff took place right before World War One. That's right. States kind of held de facto elections, which means, yeah, they kind of had elections, but it wasn't really an official election. It just helped the state legislatures decide on who was most popular. And they went down the slippery slope as we moved from the local neighborhood with a local state representative on the local hill in your own state deciding who was going to run for Senate, independent of all the pressures and corruptions that go with public elections. And now, the Senate has become the antithesis of what the Founding Fathers had in mind. Now, it has become a tool of the rich. We covered Hawking saying that aliens are too dangerous. We covered the evolution of the 17th Amendment, which allowed senators to run for election, which, for all intents and purposes, are no longer state elections. They're now national elections for state senators. And it was originally supposed to be a level playing field, state by state, 50 pairs of two entering into a room as equals, a check, a balance in the legislative branch against the popular electees, which are the congressmen. They have to run every 2 years, so they're in constant campaign mode. So they have to have political machines now that run all the time. And believe me, they consume money. Everywhere they go, they are shaking a hand and looking for a check. I would say in today's fast-paced world and the ability to maneuver and to stay in touch, they're no longer sent to Washington out of touch, and then we hear by Pony Express a year later what a new law might be. No, no, no. We can find out on C-SPAN within a matter of seconds. We can have our own community activists watching the vote minute by minute, and on Twitter, within an instant, reach 50,000 people or 100,000 people or 1 million people with what's going on. You can pick up the phone and you can call, you can email, you can fill out forms, you can write letters, you can fax, and you can go by and visit the local offices. You have a lot of communication with your congressman. And that's why I think Congress should run every 4 years instead of every 2 years. Let's get them out of campaign mode, at least for a couple years, and see if we can't get some work out of them. In this hour, by the way, if you want to be part of the program, it's 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161, and if you can get close to a cell phone tower anywhere on planet or off planet, you can reach us. So this hour we are going to talk about 2012, some aspects of it anyway. It's a big subject, and if you want to learn more about it, you can pick up the definitive books on 2012. When we began writing our series, there were perhaps five titles on 2012 that were contemporary, and now there are 1,000. So if you want what Forward Magazine calls the most comprehensive work ever done on 2012 and the end times, you need to pick up this series. It's called The Arc of Millions of Years. Myself and my co-author put it together from 2001 to 2004. It was published in late 2004. It was a national bestseller by March of 2005. And the predictions made in that book were taking place the months immediately following after the books came out. The final book was put out in 2006. It's called Unlocking the Secret, and it's 1,500 pages and over 300 works of art, drawings, diagrams, and pictures to help you stay thoroughly informed on what's going on. One of my Skypers writes in, Jim, and he says, seems we are of coherent world awareness. Thanks for putting yourself out there, Brooks. I appreciate your message, Jim. It just went out to the world. One of our other Skypers wrote in, would you answer me a few questions on entanglement theory? What was it based on? Particle entanglement and energy entanglement, this is a phenomenon that came experimentally as physicists got better and better at capturing particles and measuring them. There's a kind of detector we call an electron capture detector, an ECD, and it's used to electromagnetically capture a particle and hold it without annihilating it, and we can measure its spin. And what was found is that on ions that had particularly large ion clouds, like beryllium ions, we could pick pairs of particles off that appeared to be entangled. That is to say, they weren't wrapped up in the same spider web. They didn't have a string tied between them. But we could separate them by, you know, a few centimeters, which on an atomic level might as well be across the room, or across the state for that matter. In any case, one would be spinning in one direction, one in the other, sort of like an electron pair. We call it the Pauli exclusion principle. Both particles can't rotate in the same direction at the same time. It has to be a plus half and minus half so that they equal out, mathematically speaking, balance of charge and all that. But as it turns out, without actually directly affecting one particle, the other particle's spin can be electromagnetically switched. We just affect it with the field and reverse its spin. Mysteriously, albeit repeatedly, the other particle would change spin at exactly the same moment. No, I mean exactly the same moment. Way faster than the speed of light. And as stasis techniques got better and better, we began separating the particles further and further until the aspect experiment did it 11 kilometers apart. 11 kilometers. They separated two particles. They reversed the spin on one, and instantaneously it changed on the other as well. And now there are beryllium ions headed out into space. They are millions and millions of miles from here. And we are expecting that when we command that onboard experiment to switch the spin of that particle, that its sister particle here on Earth will change spin instantaneously. Now, what this has done is it's opened an empirical lock. That is to say, we have real-world evidence. We just don't know why we have empirical evidence. And what we're trying to do now is put together theories and then test those theories with hypotheses and then back up the hypotheses with experiments. And one of those theories is that these particles are somehow entangled on a subspace level, on a dimensional level that we don't understand. And one of the other ideas is that they are actually the same particle by locating. Yeah, they're actually the same particle existing in two different places at the same time. One plus half, one minus a half. And, you know, these are the theories. Now, the experiments to prove or disprove that theory abound. And I'm sure there are Nobel Prizes to be had when we understand why this happens. Why the observation effect on one particle affects the other particle a virtually infinite distance away. Now, we can make all kinds of extrapolations. We can break this out into consciousness. We can talk about bilocality. We can talk about non-locality, a non-local universe. And we can also talk about alternate dimensions, parallel universes. It opens up a lot of ideas that we can talk about. What does this have to do with 2012? Well, as we have a plethora of great information in our archives at xsquaredradio.com. You should go back and you should listen to the Jose Arguez interview. Now, this was an individual. He's still alive, by the way. An individual who became intimately in touch with the tapestry of the energy of 2012 in the late 50s, when he was first introduced to the tomb lid of Pakal, P-A-C-A-L. You can look it up on the internet, or, even better, you can buy the Ark of Millions of Years series by going to arkofmillionsofyears.com and ordering it, and you can look at the tomb lid and understand the analysis of it. Not only from an archaeological point of view, but also from a physics point of view. You don't get that in the same book, because you don't normally have two authors working on the same work from two different points of view. That's what you get in the more than 1,500 pages that makes up this trilogy. Pakal was a giant. He was close to 9 feet tall. He had 6 fingers and 6 toes. And if you look at depictions of him and his son was slightly smaller than him. His son was still far taller than the Maya were. Pakal had a tomb lid which was extremely elaborate. And it was a stylized representation of the Milky Way galaxy and the alignment of Earth with that Milky Way galaxy. The image of the serpent bar, the iconic arrangement of Earth with what he called the vagina of the galaxy. the rift, the black rift that you see. If you don't have any light pollution, you could step outside, look up at the sky, at the Milky Way sprawled across the sky from horizon to horizon, and you can see the dark rift down the center of it. This is where the black hole is in the center of the galaxy. This is where light cannot escape. And Earth and its solar system is very soon to align with that plane. And this is what is primarily responsible for all the Earth changes. In fact, responsible for all the planetary changes in our solar system. Now, that being said, the particles that create a solar system, or for that matter, maybe a section of a galaxy, come from supernova events. A supernova is one of the stages of the death of a large star. A star at least four times the size of our sun. Our sun doesn't have enough mass to do a supernova event. It will just turn into a red giant and then slowly become a brown dwarf. It will never become a neutron star because it doesn't have enough density. Now, if it was four times the size of our sun or bigger, at least four times the size of our sun, then it would have enough mass to go through a different kind of death cycle. As it loses its explosive force and quits trying to blow out into the universe, which is then balanced by the gravity of its own body, that's why it's a star. As it begins to lose this battle against gravity, all the hydrogen becomes used up and turns into helium. Things begin to simmer down from an explosive point of view, and the star begins to slowly expand like a red giant. And it will consume the first two or three bands of planets in the solar system. And then it will cool, and it will begin to collapse. And as it collapses, of course, it picks up in spin, and it picks up in local gravity and density. It goes from about, 5 to 8 grams per cubic centimeter to about 14 to 18 grams per cubic centimeter, which is getting pretty darn dense. It's getting pretty close to crystalline form. Now, that being said, you're only talking about helium here. Not a whole lot of carbon, not a whole lot of iron, not a whole lot of the other elements, mostly helium. Around the helium, happily, very stably floating, two electrons. Two electrons, two protons, floating around, minding their own business. But as gravity increases, sooner or later, the electrons cannot escape. They are pulled into the protons. First one, then a billion, then a trillion, then a gazillion. Somewhere in that event, there's a sudden collapse. That is to say, the rest of the electrons in the star jump into the protons, and all of the protons become neutrons. Almost instantly, relatively speaking, from a cosmological point of view. The concussion from that event is called a supernova. It cleaves off the atmosphere of that star. It turns all of the planets within, depending on how large the star is, within at least a couple of solar system diameters, into pure energy. That being said, all of that energy forces the quiet energy of that solar system into much higher energy states. So more complex, heavier elements are created during that event, all at the same time. That means all of that new matter created in that supernova event is entangled. It's all entangled with one another. As it recollapses into planets, and life then springs forth on those planets and consumes the matter that makes up those planets, becomes what you look at as the body, all that calcium and protein and everything that makes up that bag you're walking around in. That came from Earth, which means you are now entangled with Earth. And we'll pick this up in just a minute. Mark from Ohio, welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. I had a few things I thought I would bring up concerning 2012. I just stumbled over a new theory that I thought was very interesting by Jay Widener. He has a little little thing out on the exopolitics.com site by Alfred Weber. What he talks about is kind of interesting because it kind of pulls a lot of different things together. You know, the Nazis had such tremendous technology advances from 1930 to 1945. They invented the laser, they invented radar and television, and some say they had a bell type disc craft which was powered by spinning mercury. And Jay Widener claims that he believes that there is another race on the earth here, and they're known by three different names. The Germans call them the Aryans. Other people have called them the Nephilim or the Anunnaki, and Jay describes them as being having such white skin that you can see the capillaries in their body, that they look almost as white as a piece of paper. And I remembered Charles Hall, you know, his whole story with the tall whites, and he said that every 2 weeks a large black titanium mothership would land near Dogbone Lake and then move off into the side of one of the mountains there near Indian Springs. Well, what Jay is saying is that the Aryans were basically the ones that gave the Nazis all the technology, and the Aryans, or these tall whites, whatever you want to call them, are the people that are really in charge of the New World Order, and that at the end of this cycle, they leave the planet just before the solar flares come, and they go and stay on Mars underground for maybe 50 years or 100 years or however long it takes, and then they come back to the Earth when things start to clear up again. I just thought that was a fascinating theory, and I wanted to hear what you thought about that.
I think generally it's pretty true. It does resonate a lot with the second book, in the Ark of Millions of Years, which is 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times. The Nephilim, they're in pretty small numbers. It's said that there were about 200 of them that originally came to the planet. They're virtually immortal, so they cannot be killed, but they can be captured, they can be imprisoned. And they can be, you know, banished without transportation and thrown off planet. But it really takes a concerted effort. And I support the idea that either very, very ancient surviving leadership of the Earth or off-worlders, Nephilim, Aryans, Anunnaki, they go by various names, and they may even be different classes of beings. They are collaborating with the leaders of the Earth. And the leaders of the Earth are making a very risky deal. And, you know, of course, humans are notoriously deceptive. And we always think we can cheat our way or use the technology for our own upper hand. But I think they really underestimate how highly advanced these beings are. That being said, they're in small numbers, and if they're going to try to subjugate an entire planet, they have to use a global method. And the only global method that seems to work, and this is the theory that we put forth in the book, and I think that he's trying to get at, is economics. It's this control of virtually everything that's of value in the world. It's the ancient theory of alchemy, that you're turning something of no value into something of value. I mean, what could be more worthless than paper? And yet the dollars and yen and yuan and, you know, rupees and English pounds that we use, we make of value. And that's how we rule our planet. If you have no money, you can make no rules.
You know, that's very interesting because Jay called these people the high magicians or the alchemists, And he said they are what's also called the Great White Brotherhood. And that the Tibetans said that they lived under in an underground city named Shambhala, underneath the Himalayas, and that they were chalk white. So, wow, that really hits a lot of different points. And maybe that's really what's going on.
I'm telling you, the guy has got a lot of pieces right. That's, and you know, we might even want to interview him on this program because we love to talk to experts who have a little more piece here, a little more piece there. You know, we only researched for 30 years, and it's just a scratch on the surface. You know, what the Freemasons had to do with it, the Knights of Christ, the Knights Templar, going back to the Stone Builders of Tyr. How they used alchemical methods to gain control over populations, and who taught it to them. And it's repeated century after century, millennia after millennia. It's tried over and over again. But you know what really it requires? It requires global communication. It requires instant transfer of wealth from one point to another. That's why the Knights Templar became so powerful, because people would deposit money in their hometowns in France and England and Germany, and then they would travel to Jerusalem. And along the way, they would have these, and they were called checks in French, checks. And they would just go to a certain castle, turn in a check. They would be issued a certain amount of their money, which they had deposited back in Germany or their hometown, use it locally to support themselves, and that way highwaymen couldn't rob them of their entire life savings as they made their pilgrimage to Jerusalem and back. But how in the world did the Knights Templar know in Italy what they had deposited in Germany and how much they had spent along the way? You know, I lose track of that myself with my own debit card. How did they do it?
Well, it's a fascinating story, and it may have a lot of truth to it. I just thought I would throw that in, and have a good evening, and I'll talk to you next time.
All right. I appreciate the call, Mark. Good night. So as 2012 arrives, and it is by the minute now, it used to be 10 years ago when we talked about 2012. It was a distant thing. Very few people were paying attention to the Mayan prophecies back then. It wasn't until 2003, 2004, when our book came out and things really began to take off. We really took professional risks by putting out the first book, which was called New Discoveries in Light on the Creation. I mean, come on, we put in things about Atlantis and Mu, and if you say anything about those two things, that was just professional suicide. So we were really impressed at the way the research has gone and how many people have responded to it, how many people are actually competing to be the next guru in the area. And really, you, the readers, are benefiting from it, because there's some great research coming out, regardless of what egos get involved in it. There are a lot of great research that's coming out of it, and we really appreciate it. Jim writes back and says, perhaps this eternal supernova entanglement is the creation of our connected experience or consciousness. This entanglement cannot be stopped or blocked by adversaries, for we all are entangled. That's partially true. The rest of the story to that is, of course, we're entangled. And of course, we're conscious. It's just not all of us are conscious that we're conscious. And yes, we're affecting the universe, but we're doing so from our front porches in fear. We're not actively involved in love. We're not awake. We don't understand that we're entangled with one another. We don't understand, like Dr. Rowney was saying earlier tonight when we played her testimony about the Icelandic volcano. If we, by the billions, put our minds together, put our intentions together, nothing will work of the adversary. Jim is exactly right. This entanglement cannot be stopped or blocked by adversaries if we are all entangled and conscious and use our intention wisely. You know, that intention can be used for good or for ill. You can make just as much evil and fear with it as you can joy. However, we would like you to use it for joy and use it for improving the lot of humanity on the earth. Now, I want to touch a little bit more on this entanglement theory, because I didn't really answer this Skyper's question here thoroughly. They go on to say, I've heard that physicists now believe that entanglement between particles exists everywhere, all the time, and have found shocking evidence that it affects the wider macroscopic world that we inhabit. If this is so, do we tap into this? Can we tap into it purposely? What are the ramifications of being able to purposely tap into it if we can? The answer is yes, of course, we can tap into it. And yes, of course, it does have macro effects. For instance, let's just talk about what covers 4/7 of our planet. Water. Water is very sensitive to the consciousness of the beings in it. I thoroughly believe, because I've been there, I've swam with them, I have felt them, the dolphins and the whales, the cetaceans, are involved in maintaining the consciousness of water, maintaining the purity and the goodness of water. Now, what does that mean? From a scientific point of view, it's a little difficult to explain, but here is the empirical evidence. According to Dr. Emoto, according to Dr. Tiller, and several others that have done research and published recent papers, water, simple H2O, 110 degrees between the hydrogen atoms on an oxygen atom. That angle straightens out a little bit when it freezes, and that's why water expands instead of contracts, unlike every other molecule that we know of. But it can form complexes in liquid form. Not crystals, not globules, not even coagulants, but it can form organized liquid crystals within the water. It's still water. It's still wet. You can still drink it, but it has an ability to affect the memory, the usability of that water. Let me give you a good example. This is a true story. In China, there were a group of top biological experts, molecular biologists, virologists, and those that were experts at weaponizing such things in turning into germ warfare. They met for a week. Every morsel of food was carefully examined. Water was sealed in bottles, and obviously from a plant somewhere, filtered carefully and brought to them. Nobody outside knew that they were meeting. This was a meeting in secret, and it would never have been made public, except something very strange happened. Within a few days of consuming nothing but basically raw foods, light foods, and bottled water, everyone became deathly ill. No poison was found in their systems. They almost died. It was the water. The darkness of their consciousness and the evil of their design affected the water that they were drinking, and the water nearly killed them. That being said, the way water crystallizes, I could tell you, it goes back a long way. It's what my first experiences of stereophotography in the late 1960s. This was polarized light that was used to photograph crystals as they form, on a frozen sheet of glass. These temperatures were taken down to the point where crystals began to form, and actually movies were taken of water crystallizing. It seemed to be fractal, it seemed to be random, but it was nevertheless unique and striking to the eye. Well, as it turns out, Dr. Emoto did some amazing work with consciousness, intention, affecting water crystallinity. As the water was frozen, that structure I was telling you about, that's still in liquid form, makes itself evident. Because the randomness of the way water forms now begins to be non-random. It begins to be organized and repeatable. And sure enough, intentions like love and intentions like you're an idiot and intentions like peace would make the water form different crystals. The ones that were, shall we say, fear-based or not joy-oriented, not love-oriented, would create misshapen, almost distorted or altered crystals, broken in their sequence, unable to form in the normal snowflake type of crystal. And those that were affected with love energy, high-level intentions, formed beautiful snowflake patterns, wonderful symmetry and beautiful to the eye. It was clear and repeatable that water was responding. Simple oxygen, simple hydrogen, and we have an ocean of it on our planet. Are we entangled with everything? Yes, we are. Is our intention entangled with that? Yes, it is. And will the seas leave their bounds the way prophets have foretold? Yes, they will. If, and only if, the conditions of the leaving of those bounds are met. Remember, prophecies are not predictions of the future. They are conditional upon us. Conditional. They're not predictions that this is going to happen regardless of whether you repent or not. Not so. Never was meant to be that way. It was always meant to be written as a cause and effect relationship. If and then you do this and the planet does this. Is it the hand of God? Yes, it is. Because you are involved in it. You are having the effect. You are the cause. And so when people come to you and say, oh, gee, this terrible storm happened and wiped these people off the beach. Well, those people didn't deserve that. Why, that was just a random act of God. Yeah, it probably was. But I'll bet you can go and find out what was really going on in those areas. You'll see. They could have affected it the other way. Because we have scientific evidence to back this up. Now, goes on with the question. What are we to do with the U.S. government and their National Science Foundation, who recently published a key document stating, quote, the majority of the general population is stupid because they believe in psi and of the pseudosciences, close quote. Who, in your opinion, is closer to the truth, the general population or the National Science Foundation? Well, for one thing, I think there's a misstatement here, a definite misstatement. The general population is stupid, but not because they believe in psi. It's because they don't believe in psi. It's because the general population is asleep. I see them almost every day on the freeway driving their cars in solitude. They're asleep. They're not awake. They don't know what's going on around them. They don't know anything. Except they've got to make it from one payday to the next. They don't know anything about their entanglement with the universe. They complain and they gripe and they gossip and they backbite and they hate. And they have no idea that they are affecting the universe when they do this. Now the ones that are awake, the ones that love, the ones that realize that there is a karma that goes out from what and how they treat other people, there is a karma with what they dwell on with their mind, because what you think about, you will act on, and what you act on will affect not only you, but those around you, your children. the people next to you in the grocery store when you do what you do to your children. Remember, everything you think about will eventually affect the universe. Now, if you can fight off your thoughts for your whole life and never act out anything that you've thought about your whole life, then you're dead anyway. You might as well go ahead and master your thoughts. Control your eye and control your mind. Master your thoughts. Focus on what you want to be. Focus on what you want to do. And then work. Get off your butt and go put some labor into it. Learn and listen and labor again. If you work that way, if you put your energy out that way as a conscious and awake being, realizing that what you think and what you do and what you are will determine what you have. And if you're conscious enough, if you really get it, you'll understand it doesn't even matter what you have. It matters even less what they have. All it matters is what you are and what you're doing to be. So those three things tie together. So I would say, in order for this person's statement to really be true, the majority of the general population is stupid because they are asleep. But those who believe in Psi and of the, quote, meta-sciences, we won't call them false sciences, because the scientific method is not false. The scientific method of experimentation and theory and hypothesis and proof and fact is a proven method, and the human body and a direct observation are completely legitimate in science. Now, if you want to say that that if you're obeying the scientific method, it's a pseudoscience, I would say you have narrowed your definition according to your ego, and you are a scientist no more, because you are now throwing out legitimate data. I would think those that believe in Psi and are actually participating in that kind of experimentation are the real scientists. Jim writes back and says, thanks for your confirmation of loving intention. Be loving intention, living it. Exactly right, Jim. Exactly right. We have to remember, we are Source. We're not separate from it. Never were. Can't be separated from it. The universe is the sum of the intentions of every sentient being in it, whether they are conscious or not. So you might as well be conscious, you're conscious. You might as well be awake and alive. Who wants to go through life dead? We see enough of it. Come on, you work with them every day. You want to be like them? You want to be dead? You want to live life paycheck to paycheck, family vacation to family vacation? Why don't you try living life moment by moment and experimenting with it? Collect data and respond and adapt and change what you're doing as you are who you are. And control your thoughts, because they will become reality. He further writes, what do you think of this recent research on inattentional blindness has shown that even minor tweaks to one's expectations can cause a form of blindness. A simple experiment developed by University of Illinois psychologist Daniel Simons provided a dramatic demonstration of this effect. People have taken Simons' experiment and literally gasped in astonishment when they discovered that they've overlooked the obvious. Here's the experiment. It consists of a 25-second video clip of six people playing a basketball game. Three are dressed in black t-shirts and three in white. Hurry up and write here, because we only have about 3 minutes. Type faster. I'll read it to you as fast as it comes in. But I can tell you right now that this kind of blindness exists. The white team is passing a basketball amongst themselves. This could just be a matter of observation, but we'll see. The black team is doing likewise. I've lost it, and I can't type fast enough. All right, hold on a second here. It's coming in. Let's see. During the game, a person dressed in a black gorilla suit calmly walks into the middle of the game, beats his chest, and then walks off. Well, we will call that the coach. The gorilla is not understated or camouflaged. It's blatantly obvious. And yet the majority of people viewing this clip do not see the gorilla, provided that they're given a very simple instruction. Count the number of basketballs tossed between the members wearing white t-shirts. This minor deflection of attention is sufficient to cause complete blindness to something as obvious as a gorilla. The power of deflecting attention is well known in stage magicians who specialize in creating such illusions. If we can so easily overlook a gorilla right in front of us, what else might we be missing? When the National Science Foundation bemoans the public's belief in topics it doesn't happen to believe in, who is being blind? Exactly my case. Exactly my case. Those who are not awake, and by the way, that would be a typical National Science Foundation experiment because they would just throw out the data. Throw out the data that the gorilla was there. So interesting. Well, again, it's been a great pleasure tonight. Gosh, 3 hours go so fast in this program. This is X Squared Radio. We come to you live each Sunday evening between 5 and 8 Pacific. Again, May 13th through 17th, I'll be at Questers in the Questers Conference in Calgary, Canada. To find out more, you can click on the Questers banner there at X Squared Radio. If you're in the area or have some frequent flyer miles you want to use up, that would be a great 4 days to make. If you're going to be in the upper northwest, or you can drive it, or you can fly it, it's just about 2 hours north of the Portland airport. A shuttle will pick you up there at the airport if you can make your way there. Come to the conference. It's July 4th weekend. It's going to be big. If you ever wanted to see a UFO, though, people, this is the place to go. It's ECETI.org, ECETI.org. The link is at X Squared Radio and on BBSRadio.com. And don't forget to go to Web Talk Radio and listen to X Squared Radio. It's a small 30-minute program. The more of you that listen to this and tell your friends to listen to it, the faster we get syndicated, and that's what it's all about. Let's get out on the airwaves, and let's try to put as positive a message out there as we can. Thank you, Earth Explorers. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.